Friday. Door open at 8 o'clock. Close at 2 in the morning.
Every man say you are the baddest teach.
Friday and Saturday night.
It's a chance for your media. Them have the lockdown in the cage. Adija, Mr. Palmer. Life lesson, whistle me, teacher. Life lesson, whistle me, teacher, Life lesson, whistle me, teacher, Life lesson, whistle me, teacher, Adija, Palmer. Life lesson, reggae, music, incision, Music is the way.
It's for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K-sor,
kitten,
cam,
seat, wait, fianrofse, you, unbearable,
you is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T. Trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one, T,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
La vaccination contre la COVID-19 se poursuit partout au Québec. L'effet combiné des deux doses assure une meilleure efficacité du vaccin, en plus de réduire le risque d'avoir et de transmettre le virus. Vous serez aussi protégé sur une plus longue période. Il est primordial de vous présenter à votre rendez-vous pour la deuxième dose du vaccin, peu importe ce qu'il y a d'autre à votre horaire. La deuxième dose du vaccin est essentielle. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
We're all learning to live with the new normal.
This will be the new normal.
New normal.
You're listening to No New Normal, a special edition of CKUT's Off the Hour. The series aims to unpack the questions raised by the COVID-19 outbreak, examining the rifts exposed by the pandemic, and the convergent struggles that are emerging in the aftermath of the quarantine. No New Normal broadcasts from Jojage, the unceded territory of the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee Nations. You can catch us here on CKUT 90.3 FM every other Friday at 5 p.m. I'm Athena Khalid. Stay tuned for our third episode, People, Not Workers, Migrants and the Borders of Viral Capitalism. In Montreal, some of the neighborhoods that have been the hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic are Park Extension, Montreal North, and Cotonnage. It's no coincidence that these three neighborhoods are home to large segments of Montreal's migrant communities, and that these three neighborhoods are disproportionately home to the working poor. Many migrants, especially those here with temporary work permits, work precarious jobs where health and safety standards were already being neglected. When the pandemic was declared a public health emergency in March, many migrants found themselves working jobs deemed essential, working as orderlies at long-term care facilities, at meat plants, in warehouses, as domestic workers, or as farm workers, without any adequate protection. Of course, many of these migrants couldn't work from home or take time off, and the problem was compounded for those working multiple jobs. A number of employers who used temporary workers agencies were the sites of outbreak, which led to the spread of COVID-19. In March, migrants held at the Migrant Detention Center in Laval went on a hunger strike. On March 19th, people detained at the center sent a letter to Public Safety Minister Bill Blair, the Canada Border Service Agency President John Osowski, and other government officials demanding their immediate release. On March 24th, after not receiving a response, 30 detainees went on an indefinite hunger strike. People inside said that social distancing was impossible in the center and that the only way to avoid an outbreak was to be released. Migrants detained in the CBSA's holding center in Laval suspended their hunger strike on April 1st, as many of those on strike were released. Around 20 migrants remained in the center, but most were released over the course of April. However, it seems that the CBSA has since started refilling the center with migrants on deportation orders, despite the moratorium. Here's Abdul, who was detained in the Laval Migrant Center from January until April, and who was involved in the hunger strike.
The conditions was the same for us. We didn't see much change. We didn't see them take measures on time. I can tell on time, and especially like serious measures to protect us. And we noticed it. And at one point, we had to talk to the immigration agents and just let them know that we're not feeling safe. Because at one point, we were still the pandemic was declared all around the world, and we were still having people coming from overseas, freshly from the airport. And when we asked them, like, they told us that they never seen doctors or any medical checker. Which was the opposite of what the immigration agent told us. So that was when we really started getting worried about our health in that place. Because it was, I was talking earlier about the common area, which is pretty much a closed area. There is pretty much no window. And there's the guards that are more or less than 15 people. Patrolling around, walking around, so we all plus the detainees, so we all lacked in that one environment, which is not even that don't even have windows. So we were very worried about the situation. That's why at one point we start putting pressure on the immigration agent for them to do something.
And so, what led to the hunger strike itself?
So after many tries, after many times trying to talk to the immigration agent for change, they didn't do anything. So that's how we decide to try to talk to the people outside, and especially the politician or the people that decide, to let them know that we just risking they locking us there, and we in the risk of getting contaminated. So at first we did make a petition, and I made everybody sign it. And at that time we all knew solidarity across borders, and they helped us put us in touch with the journalist, and we were able to take out our petition. And as we did, everybody signed it. We sent it out, but we waited, and the situation was still the same. And we were getting the news that the pandemic was the COVID was growing, and now it's a pandemic, and it's in Canada. Like, everybody was getting more worried. So we decided, like, after talking with all of us, we just decided to make a hunger strike. Because we were that scared and that worried about our health, so everybody just decided to make one, like go on hunger strike and let the world know what we live in, and try to get help.
So you were released, but were others released as well?
Yes, pretty much. Everybody that was doing the hunger strike, they've been released, and even the others too. At one point, there were only two people left in the center. Right now, I believe that they did send new people over there, but yes, at one point, pretty much everybody got free.
And can you tell me about the conditions of your release?
It was there was an amount of money as an amount of money, $700 for guarantee, I had to have a sponsor, which was my sister, and I got to live at her house, and also another condition is to call at a number, since we cannot at that time we couldn't go there because of the confinement. But it's still going. We just make phone calls twice every month for me. And yeah, the fact that I have to take care of my travel document as soon as the embassy opened.
And so would you say that the hunger strike then was a success?
To me, it was, because we could express what we were living in there. We had a lot of support from outside. Even I can remember there was kids sending us drawings and messages of support, which was a sign that a lot of people was supporting us too. So, and also the fact that we got released a little after that. So yeah, for me it was a success. I don't regret it.
And can you tell me a bit about your situation now? What you know about the future of your case and your status in Canada?
For my case, from the immigration perspective, from the immigration agent's perspective, they trying to send me home because I have a deportation order. But at the same time, I'm with my lawyer, we're fighting at the federal court for humanitarian reasons. So I can say that it's still a fight for me, and I am not sure how it's gonna go. But for right now, everything been on hold. Like nothing was moving since the COVID-19 pandemic. So right now, I don't know what's gonna happen. I'm just waiting.
That was Abdul, who was detained at the Migrants Detention Center in Laval from January until April. In the case of the Migrant Detention Center, a hunger strike led to most of those detained to be released on various conditions. But the fact that so many migrants have precarious status and are working precarious jobs makes it difficult for them to mobilize in similar ways. Here's Mustafa Henaway, a community organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center, to give us some background on migration to Montreal and to tell us about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the migrants who live here.
So my name is Mustafa Henaway, and I'm a community organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center here in Montreal, and I've been there for 13 years now, and working with precarious immigrant and migrant workers to organize both for their labor rights and around migrant issues and questions of migrant justice, both on the collective and individual level. And beyond that, I'm also a writer and have been writing about these issues in terms of precarious labor, migration, globalization, but also particularly the context here in Montreal, and currently doing my doctorate at Concordia in geography. So the Immigrant Workers Center was founded in 2000 and is an organization based in Côte des Neiges that really began as a way to really think through the questions of globalization and who was impacted by these sort of these local manifestations, right? Both in terms of the way that people were forced to migrate through these temporary foreign worker programs, particularly at that point, live-in caregiver workers from the Philippines that were here as temporary workers working on closed work permits, who were unable to access their basic labor rights and still cannot to this day as a result of the way that the program is structured. And to fill the void because unions weren't taking those communities and those jobs very seriously. One, because of the challenges that they face to organize people who work in a single home and, you know, were in a single worker in a single home. So it created a whole series of challenges. So the Immigrant Workers Center tried to fill that void by creating a space to build a sense of solidarity amongst precarious immigrant and migrant workers and their communities to defend both their basic labor rights, but also their immigration rights. So, and the Immigrant Workers Center really expanded since then, since 2000, to really take on a whole host of issues. And for the last, I would say, decade, the strategy has really been to kind of to try to undermine or to roll back the way that precarious labor and particularly amongst migrants, is managed and is structured, right? And one of the things, the two large things that we see as being sort of central to precarious work in the modern day context is not the ideas of, let's say, self-employment or the ideas of that there's less work or even the gig economy. The way that I would say that our perception is that it's about the relationship to work that has fundamentally changed, and particularly for immigrant and migrant communities. So you look at the 90s, where a lot of people who were immigrants were here as citizens. They were able to attain permanent residency. They worked, let's say, in textile and the garment sector, and those were full-time jobs. And there was a sense of kind of security, stability, and that all of that changes, particularly after the financial crisis of 2008, where you have this move towards, you know, you have the deindustrialization of Montreal, you have the move of a lot of textiles to the global south, and then you have this rise of two forms of precarious labor. One is placement agencies, which will really be the mechanism in which a lot of immigrants will find jobs, right? It's the no CVs required. Regardless of your status, there's always the possibility to find more work. You know, it sort of plays into the idea that, you know, people don't have quote unquote Canadian experience, but a lot of these jobs through these temp agencies are sort of permanent temporary jobs, right? So in like meat processing and chicken processing, where a lot of these workers aren't even paid minimum wage, they're paid below the minimum wage, high rates of extremely dangerous accidents, people facing deportation, and then even for those who have some status or work permit, they're working through these big agencies where they don't have the right to unionize. They're working in warehouses and distribution centers, and most of them are desperate to attain that job or keep that job, so they accept a whole host of issues in terms of workplace abuse, in terms of health and safety, wages, the right to organize. And then the other crux is really the temporary foreign worker program, which brings in, you know, over 300,000 people on this temporary migration status, whether seasonal agricultural workers, whether it be people just through the low-skilled pilot project, where people are working either in trucking, on farms, and large industrial meat plants like Olly Mill or Cargill, what we saw in Alberta in terms of the outbreak there. And a lot of them are coming on closed work permits. So as a result of these closed work permits, their relationship to the workplace has changed, right? They feel a sense of loss of power because if they're fired from their job, they have a limited time to find a new employer, a new LMIA or labor market impact assessment, which means that they can then be hired through the program. And so as a result, they're unable to speak up. They're unable to leave their job. You know, the basic contract that we have in our economic model, which is that you can fire me, but I can also leave my job, right? And these workers don't have those rights. They don't have the right to unemployment insurance once their work permit is over, even though that case was challenged by a group of farm workers that we work with. So there's really these structural issues that are tied both around their immigration status, but also sort of the relationship to their employers as a result, either through these agencies or temporary farm workers. And not only that, those demographics sort of relate to questions of also, unfortunately, a poverty and inequality that you're beginning to see in the pandemic really play out. So the two neighborhoods with the highest rates of working poverty are Côte des Neiges and Park X. So Park Extension has a working poverty rate of nearly of over 30%, meaning that people are working full time but still live under the poverty line. And in Côte des Neiges, it's roughly 28 to 29%. And A lot of that is because of people's status, because of the jobs they're working. So there's these intersections, not just the sort of immigration questions or labor rights, but then also kind of that inequality that we're beginning to see play out before the pandemic, but now really begin to shape the way the pandemic is being played out here. Yeah, so I mean, for when the pandemic broke out and who was affected and not affected, it's very clear. People who are here as immigrants and migrants didn't have the luxury, first of all, when the pandemic broke out, to telework or to work from home. Most of them had blue-collar jobs, mostly in these very low-wage sectors, precarious sectors, so food processing, warehouse and distribution, so companies, very large companies like Dollarama or Cargill, even to more local chicken plants like Concord Premium Meats. People were working as préposés through these temporary placement agencies, or people were having multiple jobs. So just to give a few examples, not related to the center, and then I could give a few related to the center. So there was a story of two refugees, both of them from Haiti, who lost their lives as a result of COVID. Both of them were refugee claimants. One of them was working as in a textile garment plant Monday to Friday, was a préposé on the weekends, bénéficiaire. And his wife was also actually working at Cargill chicken plant, which had an outbreak of 62 people, still nowhere near the size of the Cargill plant in Alberta, which had to date the largest outbreak in Canada. And so she had a precarious job. They both had a precarious job. Both of them were working through these temp placement agencies. And so the problem with the structure of temp agencies isn't through the pandemic. It isn't that, a big part of it is that you're seeing these intersections, right? People are going from one workplace to the next. They never have any stability. And so they become these sort of super spreaders, right? And we saw that throughout the long-term care homes, right? That a lot of these people were going from one home to the next in the same day. But the big problem with agencies is that employers are sort of in love or fascinated by temp agencies because they download the responsibility of health and safety onto the agency themselves. So because the agency pretends to be the employer, the real employer isn't responsible for basic occupational health and safety. So that means they get away with a lot of things that in most circumstances employers wouldn't be able to get away with. So providing basic health and safety equipment, providing proper health and safety training. And so these issues that were existing before only get exacerbated during the pandemic, right? And a lot of these jobs are sort of are fast-paced, high quotas. In cargo, people are working shoulder to shoulder. And because in these sectors where there's a very much a sort of a high turnover, a high quota system, it's because they have these low profit margins. So the faster they work or the faster they can put their output, that's the only way they can make money. So in Dollarama, this one distribution center, which has 1,000 workers, all of them work through placement agencies, 5 different placement agencies, have a weekly quota collectively to ship 2 million boxes. So if you break that down by second, by worker, a worker has to lift and move and place a box, it can be small or up to 20 kilos, every 20 seconds to make their quota. That's working through lunch, working through their breaks. And so they're shoulder to shoulder. They have one lunchroom. They can be hired or fired at any time. To give you an example, in Dollarama, 2 workers were fired because of their complaints they raised in terms of the way the agency or in terms of the way that occupational health and safety was being managed during the pandemic. One of them raised questions about other workers who had been contracted COVID. The worker had worked there for 10 years. The supervisor simply told him, call your agency. He calls the agency. He was let go the next day without any recourse, without any justification, because they just say the contract is over. You're not an actual employee. You're a temp worker. The same thing with someone else who worked there for 3 years, who was a sort of a trainer, refugee claimant from Haiti also. And workers were complaining about the way that the lunchroom was being managed during the pandemic, and making people go into the same fridge to get their lunch. He wasn't involved in this, but workers began to sort of have a little revolt inside the workplace. And workers asked him questions because he looked like a supervisor. He brought the issues up to the other management, to the rest of management. They told him, call his agency, let go the next day, told not to come back. So these agencies exercise this kind of power over workers as a result. And because people are immigrants and migrants, they feel that the sense of impunity, that they can just, you know, let go of this person, let go of that person. So it really became exasperated during the pandemic, whether it be sort of in these situations with préposés in the long-term care homes who were badly paid, you know, $13, $14 an hour, working 12 hours a day, going from one workplace to the next, never having a secure job contract. And these are the people who were doing the essential jobs. You know, when we look at Ontario right now, the largest outbreaks are with migrant farm workers. You know, they're working and living in these camps and these large industrial farms. You know, we already had 3 migrant workers who also passed away. You know, Cargill, again, in Alberta, was this plant full of, I mean, the majority of workers were Filipino migrant workers. You know, and hundreds of people contracted COVID there. And yet a lot of the bigotry and the racism backlash was that, well, it's cultural issues. They live in these big homes. They commute together. They didn't care. No one ever pinned the blame on the employer, the fact that they were working these cold, dry workplaces shoulder to shoulder and not provided equipment. So you have this moment where immigrant migrant workers are seen more and more as just being disposable in the most literal sense, as human beings, while everyone else gets to stay at home. And that really is beginning to frame or shape people's perceptions, because also look at the communities that actually have the highest rates of infection in Montreal. They're Montreal North, a high rate of Haitian and African refugees who are living there. Many of them are essential workers. It's Parc Acteville-Rey-Saint-Michel, and it's Côte-des-Neiges. And so there's this clear dynamic that COVID is spreading inside these workplaces. And this is where these outbreaks are happening, and employers that were already not dealing with health and safety only exasperated it, and for profit, only for profit.
That was Mustafa Henaway of the Immigrant Workers Center. Here he is again talking about Concord Premium Meats, a meat packaging plant with facilities in Saint-Eustache, and about the outbreaks on industrial farms in Ontario.
When it comes to health and safety, for a lot of people working cash, so Concord Meats is a perfect example. It uses multiple agencies. It generally makes souvlaki. Most of the people are South Asian who work there. They work through these agencies. It's in Saint-Eustache. And they take these agency buses every day from Parc X, and they're cramped. And people are working $8 to $9 an hour. People have children here or where they migrated from that are dependent on their sub-minimum wage, you know, salary. People accept very hard conditions. And even before the pandemic, you know, someone was talking about, well, access to rights or health and safety during the pandemic. And they had an outbreak of 24 workers. Someone said, you know, if the employer really cared about us, they would have given money to the workers who lost their hands before the pandemic. Multiple cases of have workers, you know, having their hands chopped off by equipment. And workers had to raise money collectively to support those workers because the employer didn't. One worker had died on the job and they actually had to support the worker. So people have no faith or ability to sort of access basic rights, and it's only gotten worse during the pandemic. Back in Ontario, they realized that it wasn't the temporary foreign workers on these farms that were creating community transmission, but it was actually undocumented agency workers who were also working side by side with these temporary foreign workers on these large farms. And you have that situation across the board in Quebec. Where the transport is unregulated of these workers, where the health and safety there is not regulated, and even the ability to access rights is not very secure. So it puts people in a much more dangerous position than other segments of society or in other workplaces.
Mustafa mentions the poor conditions at the Dollarama warehouse here in Montreal. There have been a number of demonstrations organized by Dollarama warehouse workers over the last few months after a number of employees were fired for raising concerns about the poor health and safety conditions at the warehouse. This is Mohamed Barry, who organizes with Status for Ghanaians. Mohamed and others at Status for Ghanaians have been working on the campaign to support Dollarama workers at the warehouse. Here he is talking a bit more about the conditions.
They're not protected, you know. There's, it's impossible to keep the social distancing. It's impossible. It's overcrowded. But like Dollarama is not supposed to be more than 200 people inside the warehouse. There are more than 300 people inside who work in the same shift.
How does like the fact that this kind of work is invisible affect the work that you're doing and the work that other people are doing to for people to have status, especially if the work that they're doing is made invisible?
It's because it's a lot of people is precarious. They have a precarious status and they are newcomers. They don't know their right. They don't know anything about the system. And there are, some of them are scared to be deported by the CBSA, the Canadian Border Services. Some of them, they have their resident permanency, but they're newcomers, still newcomers. They don't know what to do. You know, they don't know any organization to complain. But recently, some of them started to raise their voice and to talk about what is going on. You know, so they are scared to be fired too, because it's not easy for them to get a job. They have families, they have parents, so they're back home, or they have their families here. They have bills to pay always. They are not covered by any benefits from the government. It's hard, you know.
You kind of mentioned that people are scared of being deported. Can you tell me a bit about what that fear affects people's day-to-day lives?
You see the CBS, wherever you see someone or someone wants to talk to you, or you are scared, you know, you live in with fear. It's a routine, you know, all the time. So,
in terms of the Dollarama workers, how that fear maybe makes people less likely to push for their rights?
Yeah, absolutely. They take that advantage because the company knew their situation and they're taking advantage of that. That's why they exploit them, because they know they cannot complain anywhere, you know. They cannot even call the police. Yes. But hopefully it's going to change.
That was Mohamed Barry, who organizes with Status for Ghanaians. So migrants with temporary work visas who find work through temporary work agencies not only have precarious status, but are also caught in a cycle of precarious labor conditions as well. The same is true of domestic workers, who often work in isolated conditions, making mobilization even more challenging. Here's Evelyn Mondonedo Kalugai, the administrator and coordinator at PNAE.
My name is Evelyn Mondonedo Kalugai. I am the administrator coordinator of PNAE and an elected finance officer. And we in Pinay, we advocate for live-in caregivers or caregivers in the temporary workers program, who have issues on labor violations on their rights, human rights, and immigration status. And the society themselves look at them as the lowest of the lowest workers among all the workers anywhere in the world because of the traditional work of caregivers, that these domestic workers are being done by women, not paid, invisible. So it's up to now. They are considered like that. There's no value for the work that they do, but the government, you know, considers them as worker, but still they don't give them the benefits as workers, because these workers doesn't even get workmen's compensation when they get accident at work. So there's such a big contradiction on this regulation of, or classification categorizing workers.
The next question I have is how these conditions have been made worse during the COVID-19 outbreak.
Well, they were caught inside. They were not allowed to go out. As soon as lockdown was announced, then the employer will say, okay, you stay here. You cannot go out because we don't want you to carry the virus, you know. If you go in and out from one place to the next, they were not allowed to take public transport or something like that. I don't know if they use it as an excuse, you know, because if, let's say, for example, if you are an employer who is a bourgeoisie that has their kids inside to take care of, make some excuses for them to stay there. And they know that these workers are being very fearful of losing their job because they have families at home that they have to support. If they don't go to work, if they refuse to stay in and they go home and the employer doesn't want them to come in and out, then they have no choice. They have to send money to their family. But even then, because they were not allowed to go out during the lockdown, they were not able to send money. You know, it was a lose-lose situation for them.
And were there ways that people doing that kind of work dealt with or tried to respond to the situations? Were there people that contacted Pinay? What was it like kind of in the midst of it?
Well, they were asking, like, they were telling us that they cannot even, you know, they cannot even have food because they were not allowed to cook their own food or to buy groceries for their food. So it's a good thing we have thought of doing relief goods to the community who needs it. Then they were able, you know, people were registering and saying, okay, I need this. Just send me noodles, cup noodles, because I'm not allowed to cook. And I need a kettle to boil water so I can do it inside my bedroom. Can you imagine yourself being there in that situation? Can you imagine eating cup noodles every day? How can you work? How can you maintain your strength to work if that's all the nourishment you get every day? That's a sin. That's killing people, you know? You know, you're not considered a human being already. You don't put yourself in their shoes just because you are in the upper bracket of the society. You don't think about the others who don't have the It's a class struggle, actually, if you really look at it. In the capitalist system, how there are different class status of people here, you know, and it's being worsened by the capitalist system. So, you know, those who are in the working class will have to bear everything, but if they don't get together and really fight the common enemy, then nothing will happen.
That was Evelyn from Pinay. Both Evelyn and Mohammed suggest that employers exploit temporary foreign workers, and domestic workers in particular, based on their precarious status. And as Evelyn points out, this exploitation is very clearly tied to class lines. I asked Mustafa to what extent this precarity leads to a lack of access to healthcare and to rights. Here is his response.
So in terms of people's healthcare and access to healthcare, it's very poor. So if you're undocumented, you have no access to healthcare, period, right? It's not like Spain. It's not like other countries where they had access to healthcare. And even during the pandemic, people only had access to COVID-related, diseases. So getting a test. So as opposed to really dealing with this pandemic from a holistic or humanistic perspective, we still have this this perception there are citizens, those who are deserving, and those who are undeserving. And the way that's done with the access to healthcare is very much a central part of it. Because access to healthcare for everyone during this pandemic would actually limit community transmission. For migrants, they have no access to healthcare once they lose their status.
Right. And earlier you were talking also about the fact that people had been fired for pointing out the lack of health and safety in their work conditions. To what extent is people's status dependent on their employment? And if that's the case, how does that affect their ability to access and negotiate their rights?
Well, it definitely, people's status very much affects their employment choices and their ability to access their rights. So if you are undocumented or you have precarious status, you're working in the worst jobs, you live in this fear of deportation, even if there is a moratorium on deportations at the moment, you don't have access to CERB, which everyone else does, the Canada Emergency Relief Benefit. So you have to work. You're propelled into the situation where you have to work. So you're putting your health at risk, first and foremost, more than other segments of society, because you're forced to work. You don't have access to state benefit. And then on top of it, you have the fear of deportation. You have the ultimate ability of the employer to fire you because you don't exist, right? You simply just don't exist. Even though under the labor law, there's a broad, vague category, even workers who are paid cash have the ability to access their rights. But the problem is that there's no there's no law that stops them from communicating certain information, let's say with immigration. So as a result, workers are still afraid to uphold their rights, even though they have the right to. When you see that sort of play out, like whether it be in Guinea or whether it be in the rest of Africa, that's creating these movements of people to migrate, or whether it be in Latin and Central America, right? That climate change is a big driver of migration from Guatemala and Honduras, creating these large coffee droughts, the fact that United States agribusiness has, flooded and decimated subsistence farming, causing these waves of migration. And many of these people come here and work in those exact same companies that are driving migration. It's literally a full circle. And our structure, our migration regime, is never to keep these migrants out, but it's to keep them precarious. It's to keep people you know, disposable. You know, that for neoliberalism to work, you have to create the perfect neoliberal worker, right? Someone who is actually disposable, who's considered, you know, practically non-human, or a non-citizen. And that what our migration regimes are really about. And so you have this system taking place for across the advanced, Europe and North America, that's really trying to re-engineer this sort of this idea of migration, not as a human right or not on the basis of permanent migration, but what they call circular migration or temporary migration. So in the Western world, they need these migrants, but the question is under what conditions? And if they come as permanent residents, if they come as equals, then they're not disposable. They can't be made cheap labor. They can't. And so this is what really what it's about. And what you've now seen is the pandemic really lay that system of apartheid, of structural apartheid bare, right? Especially here, who is affected, who's not affected by this pandemic. And it is very much clearly tied to questions of race and class.
That was Mustafa from the Immigrant Workers Center. As Mustafa says, the precarity inherent to the temporary foreign workers category is necessary to the functioning of racial capitalism because it creates the ideal neoliberal worker, one that can be maximally exploited for the sake of profits. But our economy's dependence on this kind of work points to how essential it is, which has been made even clearer during the pandemic. Here's Evelyn talking about domestic workers as frontline workers.
Well, it's the status, their status. Like if the government can regularize frontline workers who are refugee claimant, why can't they do it for everyone who has a temporary a precarious status? Don't divide them. They are also workers. I mean, domestic workers are frontliners too. If it's not for them, and they will, they will have to go. They won't be able to function. The family will not be able to function. Their bourgeois class will not be able to function without these domestic workers. So you know. They are also frontliners. Those who are working, taking care of an elderly alone at home. If that elderly was in a residence, long-term care, will they have a 100% guarantee that elderly will be alive by now? Look what they are doing, but they are not considered frontline. They're not considered that they are doing something really to prevent the safety or to provide the safety of an elderly that prefers to stay home. I don't know why they are being excluded in the society.
That was Evelyn from Pinay. And here's Mohammed also talking about migrant workers as not just essential workers, but as essential people.
I just want to add to the government to regularize everyone, those people. They're calling them essential workers. They are not essential workers. They are essential people because the pandemic have shown how much they are essential, how much they are willing to contribute to the economy of this country. How much they are part of this country, how much they are part of this society. Because they cannot live here. They made a great network here that they cannot destroy in 2 weeks.
That was Mohammed from Status for Ghanaians. Here's a bit of my conversation with Mustafa about the uneven borders within the global north and on the increased momentum and calls for regularization.
One thing that I was thinking about while you were kind of in response to what you just said is that the narrative, I think, especially in Canada, is that, that immigrants can come and set up their lives. And there's kind of this narrative of immigration that's very much tied to the permanent resident class that makes the kind of the temporary workers very much invisibilized, and the work that they do is invisibilized. And I guess I was just thinking about that in relation to kind of the global north, global south dynamics, but how that plays out within cities, like within cities in the global north themselves.
No. Exactly. I mean, it's not that those dynamics are simply on a global scale, but I mean, they play out on these micro scales here, in particularly in the global north, in terms of in terms of those dynamics, in terms of inequality, in terms of invisibilized labor that's sort of central to the reproduction of global capitalism, both in the local sense of these cities, but then also in the more global sense. And we saw that with the pandemic, right? And I think that fueled a lot of not just tragedy, but empowerment of these communities, right? Where they realized, you know, something clicked, you know, all of a sudden we're the ones who are taking care of people's children. We're taking care of the sick. Without us, no one would have food. Without us, many segments of society, or what people call life-making work or social reproduction, wouldn't exist without these immigrant and migrant communities, invisibilized workers. You know, the global south within the global north would not happen. And so that's why I think you're beginning to see this, you know, more of this massive movement now to calling for regularization, or to calling for status for these communities, or people beginning to go on the strike, or people beginning to exercise some sense of collective power on an individual level. You know, in Montreal, for example, in Quebec, there's been double the amount of labor complaints this year than there had been in last year. So people are beginning to, you know, take out their frustration, their anger, but also realizing a sense of importance in society as a result of that dynamic, but realizing that it wasn't them that was reliant on sort of a, you know, on the global north here, or relying on those employers, or relying on these states, but also the fact that they were relying on them. So I mean, I think it's extremely inspiring to see all of a sudden, and whether that results in any permanent changes. And you know, as long as trying to get other people to support, because this question of essential work now is really, you know, in people's consciousness, but it's about trying to keep it there constantly. And, you know, tying that also to other things like the broader questions on race that are being, and colonialism that are being tackled now, right, through post the brutal murder of George Floyd, is to tying those issues to those issues in terms of race and colonialism, which they're very much intrinsically are.
One last question would be, if you could tell me a bit about these like the increase in calls for regularization and the mobilization around the campaign for status for all.
So I guess, I mean, since the early days of the pandemic, you saw these great grassroots initiatives take place on several fronts, but all very interlinked, you know, with solidarity across borders. Many of its members didn't have access to the CERB or to any state benefits. So they began fundraising on a massive scale, you know, nearly $100,000 as a mutual aid fund to non-status people here in Montreal. And then you saw this formation of people who were undocumented beginning to actually just speak out and calls for regularization. So you had within Solidarity Across Borders, this movement of non-status people themselves beginning to take a leadership role, calling for status, and they launched an open letter. You also had other initiatives around the Immigrant Worker Center, which also launched an open letter by a group of undocumented women calling for CSQs, access to health care, you began to see a movement of workers, you know, Dollarama as an example, where workers spoke up, were still employed there. You know, and not that they have a union, not that they have job security, that they were willing to speak up and meet and organize despite the challenges. You know, and then you have obviously the movement, Début pour la Dignité, which was beginning to call for the regularization of guardian angels, these refugee claimants working through temp agencies in the long-term care homes. And the government had to budge to the point that they caved into the regularization, or the rhetoric at least. There's no specifics yet. But yes, that these people should have some status, or there should be some program for them. And I think that really empowered other segments. I was doing essential work. I was a baker. I was a distribution worker. I was working in a meat plant. That was essential work. Where's my status? Or where's status for everybody? And so now that sort of empowered a broader movement for regularization. So you had the demonstration on July 4th that was calling for status for all, which was extremely diverse. Right, hundreds of people out on the streets. You know, women who were working as in long-term care homes, truck drivers from the Philippines were present. People who were released from the detention center in Laval were also present. And people who have been here undocumented for quite some time were also present and felt empowered, but also community allies. So it's really about building a broad movement now of all of these immigrant and migrants, because there is this window now that exists and won't exist for much longer. So it is really important to build a movement, both of migrants and directly affected people themselves, but also broader allies, because without it, people who are directly affected may not have this opportunity again to actually to win some kind of regularization program.
That was Mustafa from the Immigrant Workers Center. So the yearly Status for All March, organized by Solidarity Across Borders and other organizations that took place on July 4th, holds a new significance this year. As Trudeau and Legault have moved towards the rhetoric of regularization for health workers in particular, groups like Solidarity Across Borders, the Immigrant Worker Center, Status for Ghanaians, PNAE, and many others continue to call for status for all migrants. For more information about the Status for All campaign, you can visit Solidarity Across Borders' website and have a look at their principles for a regularization program in Canada. You can also sign their petition for Status for All, donate to their mutual aid fund, or read the open letter on regularization as the only solution in this time of crisis. Here's Abdul, who was detained at the Laval Migrants Detention Center earlier this year, on regularization and status for all.
Status for all is just a demand of regularization of status for migrants. Not just the asylum seekers, even though they are a big number in it. It is also temporary workers that lost their status, international students, and migrants in general that lost their status in this period, knowing that the status is blocking you from having all the support, social and financial support that you need to live at least a decent life, especially in these conditions, in this situation where everyone is blocked, like not even people can go back to their country, or even if they wanted to, they staying here without any support from nobody. So for our demand was to ask the government to give those people a status so they can at least be protected and covered just like every regular Canadian.
You've been listening to No New Normal, a special edition of CKUT's Off the Hour. No New Normal examines the structural rifts laid bare by the COVID-19 pandemic and the convergent struggles that have come as a result. Today's episode was People, Not Workers, Migrants, and the Borders of Viral Capitalism. I'm Athena Khalid. Thanks to James Ward and Gal Mahadevan for production, and to Sasha Kay for the theme. Thanks as well to Abdul, Mustafa, Evelyn, Hamid for taking the time to talk to us. Tune in on Friday, July 31st at 5 p.m. for our next episode on homelessness and harm reduction.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. You're listening to a look back edition of Upstage on June 24th, 2021. Coming up, some favorite interviews from the past few months. Bonne Saint-Jean. In November of last year, 2020, Black Theatre Workshop unveiled plans for its 50th anniversary season. Despite the pandemic, they promised a very busy upcoming season.